I'm looking for the sun to come through. And the reason I am is because I'm affected by dark and gloom and fog and haze and, you know, grayness. I really am. This morning, it's in our house, as far as I know, because last evening, all of us in this East Texas community are aware of the fact that it was not as cold last night as it was the night before. And yet, when I got up this morning and looked outside and it was all gray and dreary and somewhat bleak, I'm colder. I'm even cold right now. So I'm looking for the sun to come out because I know that it'll make me perk up. Now, it doesn't mean I'm depressed. Don't misunderstand. I'm not depressed. It just as I know, as a matter of fact, that people, and I assume all of us together, are affected by physical things such as the light. So I hope that before the day is over, the sun may dawn on all of us and it might help us to have a little bit more enjoyable Sabbath. There's a verse over here in John. I'm just going to read it to you, and I want you to just listen to what it says, because this is the preface to the sermon that I'd like to give today. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. The same came for a witness, to bear witness of the light, that all men through him might believe. He, John, was not the light, but was sent to bear witness of that light. Verse 9 then says, that was the true light, which lights every man that comes into the world. So Jesus is the light of the world. We sing about it, we believe it, and yet sometimes that light seems to turn into darkness, not of his misdoing, but because of our misapplication of what is available to us through his very example. All of you know what a light does. It shines, it shows the way, it lightens up, it makes it easier to see. And yet why is it in this human experience that we live through, in this journey of life, that the light that's so readily available to us and in us, which is the Holy Spirit through Jesus Christ living in us, doesn't show us the way? Oh, it does, but we don't let it, because we may become affected by disappointment, discouragement, or even something more serious, which is what I'm going to call that which makes us sad. That's an acronym, S-A-D, people. This is the season of the year when there are a lot of these types of folks, S-A-D, people. To help you understand what that is, I'd like you to just reflect for a moment on something that is occasionally made light of, if not the brunt of a few jokes, and that is that, you know, people, if they say that they're going to be locked in a snowstorm or something with their wife and days go on, well, they can probably expect that about 3 months, nine months later, that what's going to probably happen, if likely a child might be born, they say. You know, if a child is born in the summertime or late fall, whatever it might be, they just sort of go counting back. And if it was the wintertime, they'll say, well, it was cold and, we were all together. And people talk about those things, but you know that's not true. Did you know that that's not true? I'd like to use an example, something that is a matter of research, and it involves the folks that live in Finland. It is interesting that March and April, for them, are their birthday months. They have more children who celebrate their birthday in those months than any other months. Just check back, count back 9 months, and find out, well, then when were the children conceived? And the children are conceived in June or July. And those are the long, golden months of summer, and particularly in Finland, because sometimes then, because of their location and latitude, the summer days are almost endless. They're 20 or so hours in length in sunshine. And yet, wait a minute, that's not darkness. No, it was in sunlight that all these children were conceived. What's fascinating about that is to go ahead and take a good look, as a matter of research, about what happens then in the darkest months of the year for those folks. And those months would be November and December. And you just count on out, and you'll find that in July, August, and September, they have the lowest birth rate of the entire year. Well, there's something interesting in this, because it shows that people are affected by what goes on around us, in spite of all the jokes that we might hear. And I couldn't help but think about that this morning, as I already told you about driving over here, and I thought, well, sure hope that sun perks out there today. In fact, it may even be coming through even as we're talking right now. This malady that sometimes causes depression, malaise, and anxiety in the Finns and also in us is a disease known as, or a malady known as, SAD. It is seasonal affected disorder. Seasonal affected disorder. And it actually causes people not to feel well. Can you guess which city in America is the most affected by this malady? You just sort of have to think about where do you think it rains all the time. You probably think of Seattle, right? Well, it really doesn't rain in Seattle all the time, but it does drizzle a lot. And as a result, you can't see the sun, and you're exactly right. The number one community in our country that fights this malady, which is a disorder, SAD, fights sadness, if you will, is Seattle. Oh, they do a couple of things to try to deal with it, because when it's just day after day drizzling and no sunshine, people get pretty grumpy and disoriented and unhappy, disillusioned, and some become very, very ill. It is interesting that the only thing that they can do for some people, especially those who are severely affected by it, is to actually encourage them to move away. In the local schools in Seattle, they actually have little, little recreational areas or a little bar area there where you can buy coffee. The kids even in high school can buy a coffee or cappuccino to get a shot of what? Caffeine. That's one of the things they use to try to shock them out of this malaise or this depression that comes along with day after day of dreariness. There's another thing they do, though, which I thought was pretty interesting, and it fits pretty nicely into what I wanted to say to you today. If you go into their restaurants and their cafes and the public establishments, they use UV lighting so that when people are eating and enjoying themselves, they're getting a special kind of light that they're not even aware of, and it helps them get better. Isn't that interesting? Helps them get better. Well, I was pursuing this thought because of the time of the year that it is for us here in East Texas, as well as I see all that's going on around us in our society, and I began to wonder if the same malady can creep into the church, and the answer I came up with is yes. Sadness creeps into the church as well. Because during the long days and nights of winter, and this is an established fact in the business office, we realize that people's spirits change because it's reflected in their tithes and offerings. The tithes and offerings during these bleak January and February months are not as great as they are in, let's say, September, October, and November. I'm not counting the holy days. Because people are sitting there and they're writing out their checks and they're not happy. And so guess what they do? They don't contribute as much. Now, whose fault is that? Well, it's no one's fault. It's just something that's interesting to note. And I'm just presenting it to you today because I want you to realize that sadness, well, the only thing I'm going to change it just a little bit, it's spiritually affected disorder gets into God's church. And it slips into God's people as well. Because I can show you people who are just terribly discouraged and they're filled with anxiety and unhappiness. And it makes them lethargic. And it's just so hard for them to get jump-started, if you will, spiritually speaking. Is it possible, do you think, that you might be a victim of this terrible malady? Oh, that doesn't mean that it'll take your life physically, but it might take your life spiritually. This spiritually affected disorder that can so easily affect any one of us. I think it runs occasionally rampant through our church, because in some of our congregations there is great disorientation and unhappiness. What are some of the symptoms of this disease? And I'll be talking to you about that just in a little bit. I have been listening lately to the radio, and it is inevitable this season of the year that you hear some of the most beautiful melodies that you have ever heard. At least I think so. Some of the most beautiful melodies. But because of a generous act on the part of a family member, I've been also, in conjunction with this, listening to some of the recordings with a little bit of background information of the greatest 100 people who have ever lived. And you'll probably be hearing more about this through the coming months as I go through the whole series. But one of the individuals who was talked about is a gentleman whose music you are most familiar with. In fact, I assure you, you have already heard it many times after Thanksgiving, because he's responsible for this marvelous musical composition of the Nutcracker Suite. I'm talking about the beautiful melody it carries. He's also responsible for What's the beautiful thing about Sleeping Beauty melody? I remember hearing that, if any of you are familiar with that, because we used in the Walt Disney movies. And as I was listening to this beautiful music that this man could create, I was swept along to consider the tragedy of his life. Because here was a man who gave so much to all of us, and yet he lived such a horrendous, terrible life. And I'd like to share just a little bit with you about that, because he was affected terribly by a disorder. He had several things wrong with him, and he never could get over it, in spite of all the good that he did in his life. And I'd like to just share just a little bit, if I may, of his story with you, so that when you hear some of these beautiful musical pieces, Swan Lake, here's another one I have in my notes, the 1812 Overture, which I'm familiar with as well. You didn't realize, perhaps, that it was produced by Peter Tchaikovsky, who was a man who was born on May 7th, 1840. His father worked for the government in Russia, and his mother, though, was refined, and she was a cultured French woman, and she was very dominant in his life. The story is told about him one time when he was given the responsibility when he was up in his teens, as I recall the story, and he was assigned to take a very important official document as he was working there in Moscow to a government official. And as he was walking through the courtyard and on his way, music came to his mind, and he began to think about it, and he began to chew on this official document. And by the time he got to the official to whom he was to give it, this thing was all chewed up and all soggy. And he was worried to death about what was going on. But he was so absorbed in his music. Now, he did manage to go ahead and recover from that situation, but it showed the degree to which he was completely consumed by his music, even at a very young age. The story is also told of him, and the reason I'm telling this to you is because in some of what I say, you may find yourself. All of us, I think, have little compulsive habits that we get into, things that we do that we don't know that we do. It's just in his case, he was so well known, and it was recorded, and it's here for us to know about today. But when he would sit, he would oftentimes sit at the window when it was raining and it was dark outside, and he would thump on the window pane, and because of the music and the thoughts in his mind, he would tap so hard that he would break the window pane and cut his fingers. That's concentration. That's also foolishness. But it just goes to show you how you can get caught up in something like that. Well, he adored his mother, and he could not bear to be separated from her. And through his life, and as I've listened to all these people, all the great musicians, all the great composers, all the great thinkers, and in this series that I'm listening to, they do talk about the Apostle Paul, and they talk about Abraham. They talk about some of the great men that you and I are familiar with. And I just sat there and I thought to myself, how tragic. There's so much misery in the lives of men who gave so much. And this man, Tchaikovsky, is one in which there was great misery. Well, as I mentioned to you, he was very devoted to his mother and she to him. In fact, when he was separated from her at length for the very first time, he slipped into deep, deep anxiety, what was called separation anxiety. She died when he was 14 of cholera, and he never recovered from that event. He was so dominated and close to his mother. His struggle for success was not an easy one. All along the way, there were things to discourage him and to set him back, but he managed to regain his composure and his determination, and he was relentless then to get his music out. But this is what did occur. Because of his nature, he recluded into greater and more private existence, more of a private life and a secluded life. He never stopped composing, but unfortunately, he was always unhappy, and he grew increasingly isolated. There was one reason for this. And that is because, well, probably several reasons, actually, but one of the reasons is he was a homosexual. I don't know if all of you knew that or not. But he was aware of the fact that he did not have the same disposition toward women that others of his age did, and he had great guilt over that. As a result, he did marry, but he never had any children, but the reason why he married was pretty simple. It's because he was involved with a woman who said that if he did not marry her, she would kill herself. And she was a woman who was very unstable herself. In fact, she had a habit. She would bite her nails so deeply that in the letters that she would mail to him, they were bloodstained because of the bleeding from her nails. So you can see that she probably wasn't the best influence for him. So he was married to her, and it lasted for only about 9 weeks, and then it was over. And after it was over, he went out and tried to kill himself by jumping off of a bridge into a frigid river where he was extracted and he was rescued and survived. And thankfully for us today, in terms of what he contributed musically, he did, because some of his greatest work followed this terrible despair that he went through. There were only a couple of things that gave him respite from the pain that he endured emotionally, and they were his music and heavy drinking. Those are the only two things that would give him any satisfaction. His happiest moments were those in which, since he got a little bit older, that he spent when a summer retreat at his sister's home. But even there, as the story is told, he had terrible guilt because he began to realize he had affections for his nephew. And he was guilt-ridden and in despair again. So his overwhelming guilt prevented him from being happy. Oh, he was painfully shy. He was one of the very first celebrities, I didn't know this, very first celebrities who wore sunglasses. And the reason he wore sunglasses is so that obviously nobody could recognize him. But, you know, I got to thinking about that. If you're the only one wearing sunglasses, guess what? Everybody recognizes you, because they were not very popular back then. He had a very rigorous schedule in terms of when he would get up and what he would do. He'd oftentimes skip all meals because he was so engrossed in his music. He actually placed a cot beside his piano so that in moments when he was most tired, he could just rest and get right back up and go to composing again. He did come to America in 19, well, I don't know what the year was, but he was 51 years of age. And he came here for something, and I didn't realize that he lapped over into our century. But he came here for the grand opening of Carnegie Hall. All of us are familiar with that. And yet he was terrified. Here he was, this great composer of music. He was so worried about going on stage because he was so terribly shy that he spent most of his time in his room crying. A man 51 years of age. He finally died a couple years later. I say finally, it was too soon, wasn't it, to die at age 53? And yet as I listen to the ages of all these great men that I've told you about, I'm shocked by how short their lives were. 35, 27, maybe 50. In a rare case, they might live to be much older, into the 70s or 80s. And I'm not talking about Abraham, of course, and some of the biblical figures. So he died at age 53, and it was suspected that he died either of one of two causes. He either died of suicide or he died of a cholera infection, the disease that he somehow or another obtained, as the record says, from drinking water that had not been boiled. That's hard for us to imagine, but back then it was a problem. But most scholars think that what really killed him was something else. It was that here he was in his 50s, and he was allegedly attracted to the son of a nobleman. The nobleman and his wife found out about it, and they threatened him, Tchaikovsky, that they were going to reveal his sexual inclinations to the world, which he feared, or he could kill himself. He was so afraid of his inclinations being discovered that when he was a younger man, he kept very extensive diaries, and yet he realized one day that when he died, someone would read his diaries and learn about what he thought about, and so he burned them all. And apparently because of this worry about being exposed to the world, he went out when he was 53 years of age, and he drank poison, and he died. He died a very unhappy man, despite of all that recognition and success. But all of that never resolved his longings and his loneliness that filled his life from its very beginning. Now, the reason I wanted to tell you that story is because when I was listening to this music, I just swept away with it, really. I mean, you can just put it into your cassette tape in your car or listen to it at home, and here's this magnificent music which seems to portend so much goodness, and yet underneath it was so much unhappiness and so much misery. He was not affected by a spiritual affected disorder, but he was certainly impaired emotionally and even physically. And look what it did for him, this great man. I put great in quotes. He was certainly a great musician. He committed suicide. Terrible story. It's almost depressing, isn't it? It almost makes me sad. It does make me sad. Because it goes on today as well. Now, Mr. Sharp and I and Bronson, we visited various people here recently. You know, we think about all the problems that we embrace in this life. Well, just this past week, we were visiting someone who's learned that they're coming down with the possibility of cancer. And we got back in the vehicle and we looked at each other and we said to each other, you know, we think we've got problems. There's a problem. I want you to consider with me as we go along here today whether or not you are affected as a Christian with what I call sadness, spiritual affected disorder. You know, people are affected by it. I'll tell you why. People won't get in their vehicles and come to church. They're tired. They're lethargic. They're worn out. Maybe it is that there's too much darkness in their life and there is not enough light. This is the sort of the turning of the century here. I know I'm not going to get into the debate of 2000, 2001. You know, there's no need for that at this point. But I'm one of these people who cannot resist the temptation to look at lists. Do any of you ever do that? People talk about, well, what's the best athlete of the last decade or the last century? Well, I've just got to look to see if I agree. Or what are the best songs or what are the best whatever it might be. I was reading an article recently, which I want to share just a brief moment of it with you as we talk about SAD, spiritually affected disorder, because this coming century is one that's going to be dramatically different from the one that has just passed, although the one that has just passed has been remarkable and it has not all been bad. But just a couple of weeks, we're going to turn into the 2000 or the double lot century, as you all know. I was intrigued by this particular edition of Time magazine, and I read through it. If you all take it, you might want to just earmark it or, you know, reference it and read a couple things in here, because what caught my attention was this particular item, 100 questions for the new century. And after reading it, I'm sad. I don't know if I have a spiritually affected disorder, but it's depressing. Now let me read to you 20 of the questions. It won't take a moment. Let me just go through these. These are the first 20 questions. I want you to just see if you know what the answer is. What do you think, knowing society is the way you do, what do you think would be the lead-off question? The number one question of the booklet, of the article, of the magazine. What subject do you think it would deal with? Would it deal with something spiritual? Would it deal with something entertaining? Would it deal with something physical? Would it deal with something ethical? What would it deal with? It deals with the very first question, and I couldn't help but take some amusement in this, was, because this is obviously the most important thing on many people's minds, will we still need to have sex? Now there's a dandy. First question out of the box was, will we need to have sex? Just so you'll know, the answer is no. That's what they predict. It doesn't mean that you won't. It just means you won't have to, because there'll be surrogate mothers and there'll be test tube babies and you won't need to have sex anymore. So there you go. That's depressing. Okay, we'll get off of that. Question two, can I live to be 125? The answer is, they think yes. You'll live to be 125. Three, what will happen to alternative medicines? The answer is very simple. They think most of the alternative medicines will go the way of the voodoo dolls and so forth. There'll be nothing, but there will be a few that will remain. Will we cure cancer? They're very hopeful about that. Question four, will Christopher Reeve walk? Talking about paralysis, they expect there's a possibility that he will. This one bothered me. Question number six, what new things are going to kill me? And they listed 10 things that are most likely to kill us in the year 2020. You want me to read those to you? Or are we sad enough? I might just run through them. The most likely killer of people in the year 2020 will be heart disease, followed by severe depression. That's part of being SAD. Traffic accidents, number 3, 4 will be stroke, 5 will be pulmonary disease, 6 will be respiratory infection, 7 will be tuberculosis, 8 will be, and I thought this was interesting, because 8 was not listed in those in the 1990 listing. Number 8 was war injuries. So they expect that there will be lots of tragedies by war by between now and the year 2020. Number 9, real diseases. I think that's particularly prevalent over in the undeveloped countries. And finally, number 10 was HIV and AIDS. 10 most likely things to kill us in the next decade or two. Question 7, won't take long to go through the rest. I just want you to be aware of them, let you know what society's thinking about. Will we keep getting fatter? What do you think? Yes. Got any good drugs? And they talk about all the wonderful drugs that are going to be developed in the future. Will robots make house calls? You may think you're already married to one, but that's not the issue. No, they expect that robots will play a greater part in our future. Can I replace my body? Yeah, they expect certain parts of it will be replaceable, you know, except for the head. You can't replace the head that I'm aware of. You got to keep that and however you look. And then there was a question, will Malthus be right? And this was a throwback to a gentleman who was an economist way back in the 1700s, and he made an interesting speculation. He said that the globe itself could only support, in terms of population, how many billion people? 13 billion people. And we've got close to 9, I believe, already. That's quite a... There's not a whole lot of room in there. Maybe it's 6, but it's a whole bunch of people. So the idea is that we're running on to a disaster. No, here, I'm sorry, I have a note here. They expect that the population by the end of the next century, 2100, will be 9.5 billion, so we must be about 6 now. They asked the question, what will be the catch of the day, meaning we're out of food, out of fresh seafood? Will we still eat meat? Guess what the answer to that's going to be? They suspect you won't. And then what's for dinner? I don't know if you're going to like that or not. You'll have to read the article. Will we run out of fuels, gas? No. There's plenty of gas and coal available, clear into the next couple of centuries. And yet, do you remember back, when was it, in the 50s and 60s, the headlines were blaring out what? We're going to run out of gas. Do you remember all that? Once again, we had been deceived. But there is a problem with all this gas and coal that's available. You know what it is? Pollution, especially as the world population grows. Next question is, how hot will it get? And they talk about the fact that they expect it to get a few degrees warmer. And that concerns everyone because of the melting of the ice caps, etc. Then they talk about what would a green future look like, talking about the fact that many of us will have greenhouses in our backyards to grow our own food. Can we make garbage disappear? And that's always something to be concerned about because of the pollution. They believe it will to a great degree because we'll begin to recycle more than we do now. Final question was, will there be any wilderness left? What do you think the answer was? Very little. Very little wilderness left. In all of this, I did want to take just a moment, and I am being cognizant of time here, but there was one part of this which concerned me, and I wanted to share this with you only because it has been a concern of mine for a long time. And that is under this article dealing with what new things are going to kill us. And this is of concern now as well as will be in the future. And this deals with the fact that there are new viruses out there that are being discovered, it seems like just ever too quickly. I'm going to skip through a part of it and say this. Viruses are moving into the human species because there are more of us all the time. From a virus's point of view, we look like a free lunch that's getting bigger. And then he talks about the fact that when his grandfather was born and where we are today in terms of population. Giving these laws an extra push will be the rise of tropical megacities, huge, densely packed cities in less developed nations. The United Nations study predicts that by the year 2015, there will be 26 extremely big cities on the planet, and 22 of them will be in less developed regions. And it tells you where these cities are going to be with populations like Bombay of 26 million, Karachi 19 million, and so forth. By 2030, almost 60% of the world's people will live in urban areas. I'm going to trickle on down to this and get to the point that concerned me. It said, if you take all of California, cram those people into one city, that's all of California, cram them into one city, and remove most doctors and medical care, take away basic sanitation and hygiene, and what you then have is a ticking biological time bomb. Now make 8 or 10 such bombs and plant them around the world. Now wire the bombs together. People travel rapidly by airplane, carrying diseases with them as they fly. The human species has become, and I'll end this thought, it makes me sad. The human species has become a biological internet with fast connections. There's a sobering warning in there. Well, having said all of that and been gloomy enough, what do you got to look forward to? Well, we have a lot to look forward to in God's church, and I hope the malady of being spiritually affected, having that disorder, is not in fact a plaguing problem to all of us, because it need not be. I would like you to take just a moment and turn all the way back to Micah, the book of Micah, chapter 7. There is a brief comment or two which I think we need to look at here today, because it affects lots of things. It affects our feelings toward our church and our community and our own lives and our families and our children. Chapter 7, verse 1 says, "Woe is me, for I am as when they have gathered the summer fruits, as the grape gleanings of the vintage. There is no cluster to eat. My soul desired the first ripe fruit." In other words, there's just not enough to go around. It says, "The good man is perished out of the earth, and there is none upright among men. They all lie in wait for blood. They hunt every man his brother with a net." And the reason I was reading this to you is because I think that's descriptive to some degree of the way things are now. And we got professional football players who are in drive-by shootings and killing their pregnant wives. We got that going on. We've got new threats in schools. We've got unbelievable deception in politics. And I mean, I've been reviewing, listening to it on the news, of even in the own Democratic Party, where Bradley and Gore are at each other. And it's the same thing happens in the Republican Party. It's just the nature of politics. They're just as deceptive as the day is dark. And that's what was reported on the news. It makes no difference what political genre you're from. They're all alike. And I hope we realize that. Except hopefully God can make a difference in this nation by sustaining it as we go along. He goes on to say here, "And the great man, he utters his mischievous desire, so they wrap it up. The best of them is as a briar." The best of them is as a briar. You ever gone in a briar patch? You can't move without getting stuck. That's the best of them are as a briar. "The most upright is sharper than a thorn edge. The day of thy watchman," or your watchman, "and your visitation comes, now shall be their perplexity." Now, verse 5 and 6 are of particular importance to what I wanted to preach to you about today. "Trust you not in a friend. Put you not confidence in a guide. Keep the doors of your mouth from her that lies in your bosom. For the son dishonors the father, the daughter rises up against her mother, the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's enemies are the men of his own household. Therefore I will look," verse 7, "to where? I will look to the Lord. I will wait for the God of my salvation. My God will hear me." Now verse 8. "Rejoice then, not against me, O mine enemy. When I fall, I shall arise. When I sit in darkness, the Lord shall be a light unto me." And I guess that's what this is all about. I find myself sitting in darkness too often. Not by God's choosing, but by my own. I allow myself to become discouraged or despondent or disillusioned. Or other people don't meet my expectations. And I'll just show them. I'll just be depressed. And when you are that way, you just give yourself into old SAD. Spiritually affected disorder. And whether you know it or not, you are sad. Well, what are we going to do about it? What can we do about it? We'll sit in the light of the Lord. What does that mean, to sit in the light of the Lord? There are a couple of things it means, and it may be best stated in 1 Timothy chapter 2, if you'll turn there with me. 1 Timothy chapter 2. Beginning in verse 1. Right here. There are two things that we can do as we sort of wrap up this year and as we turn into the new century. And I'll be honest with you about it. On behalf of God's church, I'm really excited about the future. The potential that is here for us to do a tremendous work far beyond our wildest imaginations is there. But a lot of what we accomplish is going to be determined by this malady that affects our church people. Now, Bronson and I were up, as he mentioned, we were really delighted to be up in Fort Smith, Arkansas, and meet with all those folks. And it was truly a great get-together. Really enjoyed being there. But I was once again reminded of what it's like for people to hear the truth for the first time. And they drive 200 miles to come to the meeting because it's life. And yet, those of us who have been around for a while, oh, it's the Sabbath again. I got to go over there and meet those people. I'm just staying home. I'm sad. You have a spiritually affected disorder. It's too easy. It just creeps into people. And next thing you know, you find yourself sitting in darkness. And what that means is you're just really without hope. You're just thinking about yourself. And like I said, all you got to do is go make a few hospital visits and you'll find out there's reality. Just like over in our neighborhood of White House in the last couple of days, one of the students that Betsy has taught before, I think it's now in high school, he's blind, as Betsy was telling me the story, but he was hit by a vehicle and thrown 100 feet in the air, and of course with great concern to his parents. All of a sudden, whether your daughter or son is involved in the drill team or the basketball or football team is not important at all when you face that, is it? Just a matter of your priorities. And thankfully, that young man is going to be okay. Now, here in 1 Timothy chapter 2, there are a couple of things here that I want to just give to you. They're very simple. There's nothing new in what I'm going to tell you here, but I want you to think about it. Because if you want to be sad, that's your problem. But don't make us sad. All right? If you want to be sad, just be sad by yourself. Leave your sadness somewhere else. Have you ever been around somebody who's that way? Just can't see the good in anything. It doesn't make any difference what you bring up. They win the lottery, and it's just because they didn't win it soon enough. You know, there's always some problem. Do you like being around a person like that? I don't like being around a person like that because it affects me. I have the responsibility to try to encourage them, because if I am filled with the light of Jesus Christ living in my life, then maybe I can let that spill over. Because I would like to think that light does dominate darkness, and it certainly does if we'll just let it shine. Two things are mentioned here. Verse 1, chapter 2. I exhort, therefore, that first of all, prayers, supplications and prayers be made, if I may put it that way. And then what? And giving of thanks be made for all men. Two things. There it is. Boy, that was really complicated, wasn't it? If you'll just practice those two things, I'll tell you that you will fight a great battle against spiritually affected disorder. Let me give you some examples of that. Are you feeling overwhelmed by your problems? Well, then you're sad. Well, why don't you do this? Do what it says here. You pray for someone else whose burdens are equal to or greater than your own. Just try that. You feel resentment towards someone, a family member, or I'll even do this because many of our co-workers here at the office are here. You have some kind of a problem with them? Why don't you just get down on your knees and give thanks to God for that person and ask God to let him or her be an instrument of growth in your life? That's tough to do. Tough to do. But it can be done. You feel alone and in the dark? You don't know where to go to next? Do what it says here. You pray about it. You make intercession. Ask God to show you the way. We could go on with being critical. I think you know what to do there. How about bitterness? You feel bitterness? How about feeling impatient over the pace of your spiritual growth? Well, why don't you get on your knees and just give thanks to God for the progress that you have made so far? Turn with me to the book of Chronicles. I want you to see something here. Excuse me, 2 Samuel. Pardon me, wrong place. 2 Samuel chapter 22. If there is any man in the Bible, and there are many, but I chose this particular one, who represents a candidate for sadness, spiritually affected disorder, it is whom? Well, there's any number. But I thought David would be a pretty good candidate. Because he had a lot to be disappointed about, a lot to be fearful of, because he was being attacked, he was being pursued, and he was a man who had made some pretty big mistakes. Now, in 2 Samuel chapter 22, we might notice just a couple of comments about what he did in his attitude toward being sad. Now, as I mentioned to you earlier, this malady can kill you. It can get the best of you. And there are people occasionally in God's church who are even affected to the point of wanting to take their own lives, just like Tchaikovsky was when he wanted to jump off a bridge into a frigid river. And these people are just so sad. There's not much light in their life. I have while you're there, I just wanted to share a story. I like stories. You want me to tell you why I like stories? Because they give me light. That's why I like stories. I like stories because I'm talking about the good ones. Because I think that they perk me up, because I think that that's what Jesus would have me do. Those are the kind of stories that I like. It tends to motivate me to be a little bit different. I received a story on the internet. Maybe you've already heard it, and if you have, well, just please listen to it again, because I think it's one well worth listening to. It's the difference between darkness and light. It's the difference between being sad or being otherwise. It's from a Jewish rabbi about his son Shea. I hope I pronounced that correctly. He's just a small boy, and he has a learning disability. That means he's not normal. And we know how kids treat kids who are not normal, don't we? Many of us were treated that way. It's not pleasant at all. So he was, you know, getting around as best he could. And one day he and his father were walking onto the field, going to the school, and there was a ball diamond there, and here were a group of his classmates. And I get the idea that he was a young man. The boy was in his 8, 9, 10, I don't know how old he was. But you know, when you're that age, you just want to be like everybody else and you want to fit in, and yet the world is filled with so much darkness toward people who are not normal, people who have learning disabilities. And here was a ball field of 18 players, maybe more, but out there all these players playing, 9 on one team, 9 on the other team, and he asked his father as he walked by, he said, "Dad, do you think that they would let me play?" And his dad thought, well, no, they probably won't, because of the way you are. He wouldn't tell him that, but that's what he would have thought. But he thought, no, for my son, and this is what fathers will do for our children, he went out to one of the players out in the field, and he asked the young boy out there, I guess he must have been in the fielding position, he said, "Would you let my son Shia play?" And the little boy, because he was so far out of earshot of all of his other mates, playmates, he didn't know what to do, so he said, "Well," he said, it's the eighth inning, we're behind 6 runs, well, bring him over here and we'll let him bat, try to get him to bat in the bottom of the ninth." All right. And the way this story is started, I'm going to give you the end of it here in just a moment, is the father was giving a speech before a group of people, and he asked this question. The question was, and he cried out at the top of his voice, he said, "Where is the perfection in my son, Shia?" Because his son was not perfect. And he went on to say that everything that God does is in perfection. So where is the perfection in my son, Shia? Now let me come back to the story. Well, the young man was on the team, and it was, they came out of the field, and their team got up to bat, and they got a couple more runs, but they were still behind, but they let him go out in the top of the ninth inning, and they put a ball glove on his hands. He'd never had a ball glove on his hands. He didn't know how to play ball. He just wanted to be a part of the team. He went out there. They put him in short center field, and nothing happened. And now is the bottom of the ninth, and during the bottom of the ninth, they got a couple more runs, and they were only, I guess, 1 run behind. And guess whose turn it was to come up to bat? Someone who had never even swung a bat. Shia. And the father wondered, what are they going to do? Are they going to let my son go ahead and bat? Or will they do what most of us would do? Put the best hitter in. Isn't that what we do? Isn't that what people do? Because of all costs, you've got to win. And then I think you'll see here who really won. So they looked at that and they decided, no, what they were going to do is they were going to go ahead and let little Shia go to bat. He went up to bat and he never really held a bat in his hand. And he hardly even knew how to swing at the ball. But the pitcher on the mound, realizing what was going on there, he came a few steps forward and lobbed the ball softly to Shia. And he swung the bat, didn't even get close. Strike one. Then one of Shia's playmates that he was with said, "Well, okay, I'm going to come over there." So he came over with him, and he helped him hold the bat. The same pitcher up there got a little bit closer and lobbed the ball in. And the two of them together swung the bat, and it was the slowest grounder you've ever seen in your life. Went right to the pitcher. Pitcher picked the ball up. He could have easily thrown him out at first base. And yet he, for some reason, threw the ball high and wild into the right field. Everybody said, "Shia, run! Shia, run to first base!" He had never run at first base in his entire life, so he just wide-eyed and somewhat not knowing what to do, just scooted on down toward first base. And by this time, the right fielder had gotten the ball, and Shia was on his way to second base. The right fielder, knowing what was happening, he could have easily thrown him out, but rather than throw him out, he too threw the ball a little bit long and wild and out of the way, and old Shia made it into second base standing up. The shortstop came over, realizing what was going on in the team, and came over to him because Shia didn't even know where third base was. He said, "Look, there's third base. Get running. Get started." And old Shia, for all he was worth, he rounded third base, and by now, all 18 players were behind what was taking place. And he came in, having driven in with a grand slam, the winning runs. And they put him up on their shoulders and hoisted him as a hero. You know who won that? You know who really won that? Not one team, both teams. That's who won that. That's a little light to me. It's a little bit of a goodness that I think Jesus Christ would want us to learn by. Don't you think? It's so unlike what goes on in our society today, just all how people are paid and what goes on in football and so forth and so on. Sometimes it takes small children to show us the light. Here in 2 Samuel chapter 22, just a quick verse of David, who was completely a candidate for SAD, being sad. And yet he wasn't. He always came out of it. And we find about all the things that were going on in his life. Verse 7, chapter 22. "In my distress I called upon the Lord and cried to my God, and he did hear my voice out of his temple, and my cry did enter into his ears." Then it tells us what God did for him. And I want to pick it up over here in verse 18. "He delivered me from my strong enemy and from them that hated me, for they were too strong for me. They prevented me in the day of my calamity, but the Lord was my stay. He brought me forth also into a large place. He delivered me because he delighted in me." Verse 21, "The Lord rewarded me according to my righteousness." You know what that means? It just means that he was making the right decisions in his life, and God rewarded him for those right decisions. Because all of us know our righteousness is as filthy rags. So what does that mean? It means he was making some right choices, and God said, "Hey, he's hit a grand slam. You may not be the most normal, but you know what? A little light can shine on you because you're doing the right things." Verse 25, "Therefore the Lord has recompensed me according to my righteousness." Now in verse 28, "And the afflicted people you will save, but your eyes are upon the haughty, that you may bring them down." Verse 29, "For you art my" what? "You art my lamp." It means my candle, O Lord. "And the Lord will lighten" my what? "The Lord will lighten my darkness." Just a couple weeks, we'll be entering into a new century. Every single one of us in this room. And I am very grateful for all of you and all the good things that you have allowed to occur in God's church in the last decade or however long it's been. We've accomplished a great deal, but we have a great deal more to do with God's blessing. We're only going to be able to do it if we somehow or another escape in our church and ourselves personally this most serious of maladies of being spiritually affected to disillusionment and anxiety, discouragement, despondency, and I'm going to give up. We have no reason to give up, in spite of all the things that I read to you about concerns of the future, because it is, as Jesus said, and it is as we had ourselves told in the book of John, Christ is the light. He is the light of the world. And maybe having said all that I have said today, that is what it really boils down to. At the heart of the matter is simply this. At the heart of it all is God's light. And that comes from Jesus Christ, our Lord and our Savior. He is the heart of all good news, now and forever. And that is Jesus in all of us.